You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey, everyone. Welcome again to the D-backs podcast. Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com D-backs reporter, Steve Gilbert. And Steve, we're going to talk about the Hall of Fame. The ballot is out. The announcement comes out next week. The ballot's been out for a long time. Kurt Schilling continues to make some gains. So we'll talk about that a little bit. Top 10 first base prospects in all of baseball are out. The D-backs, Paven Smith checking in. We'll talk about that. And then I want to start with some news, and not great news for the D-backs. Yasmani Tomas obviously trying to come back from injury and caught going a little too fast on the highways around Phoenix. 105 allegedly. He was arrested on the northbound loop of 101 in Phoenix, pulled over at 9:26 a.m. He was not impaired in any way, according to the reports, but obviously not a good look for a player at any point to be caught speeding like that. What's the latest on the story?
Yeah, that you know, you pretty well summed it up right there. It's just unfortunate. The Diamondbacks issued a statement saying they were disappointed to learn about the arrest and would not have a comment until goes through the legal procedure that it's going to go through now. But I think, as you pointed out, it's never a good thing to be speeding at that speed. But he wasn't impaired. It was a simple case, probably, of just some bad judgment on his part. So it'll be interesting to see how it works its way through. Again, I think it would have been a far different situation had he been impaired. So, hopefully for his sake, it's something that he can get settled and get back on the baseball field and be healthy, because he struggled last year trying to stay healthy with all the core injuries that he suffered.
How about that? What is the track right now? Is the understanding that come spring training he's going to be ready to kind of hit the ground running?
That was the latest I had heard from GM Mike Hazen as of a week or so ago, is that he was progressing very well and was expected to be ready when camp opened. I saw him. I was out at Salt River Field a bunch last week for the team's fantasy camp, and I saw him out there playing catch. Looked like he was in pretty good shape. So I think that everything seems to be on track for him to be ready for the beginning of spring training.
Of course, the question then will be, where does he fit into this team that did so well without him a year ago? But is there a spot for him, or does he have to kind of win his way back?
Well, I think he's going to have to win his way back a little bit, but I also think that assuming, as we all do, that J.D. Martinez is going to sign somewhere else eventually here, they're going to be counting on him to help make up some of that offense that they lost in J.D. He's somebody that 2 years ago, when he was healthy, did put up some good offensive numbers, and they know that it's in there. It's just a matter of getting it out of him and keeping him healthy. And on the one hand, yes, he will have to, earn his playing time. I think on the other hand, that they're certainly really hoping that he can do that, because he would be a big part of that offense.
Less than a month to go until spring training. Hard to believe that, but Torrey Lovello was at Salt River Field, or he's checking in, I guess, and will be there here with less than a month to go. And sounds like he's excited and getting around and talking to a whole bunch of players while he's around, as a lot of players, especially for the D-backs, because it's Arizona and they can live there all the time, are training out at the complex already.
Yeah, Torrey was out there again. I was there last week and saw him on his first day back. He was on an African photo safari. He wanted to make it clear he was not on a safari where you shoot anything. He was simply observing some of these amazing animals. But he came back and he was a little jet lagged. But the first thing he wanted to do was come into Salt River and see some of the guys that were working out. Paul Goldschmidt was there, Patrick Corbin, AJ Pollock, Archie Bradley, Jake Lamb. I mean, I could keep listing guys that were seen, have been seen at Salt River Fields. And that's where Torrey's strength really is in building relationships and being around the guys. That's what he loves more than anything. You see him at batting practice. He takes care of his media obligations and whatnot, and then immediately goes out to the outfield to be with his players and talk with them. He loves that. So, he joined them in the weight room. He joined them in the cages. just trying to catch up and reconnect with each of them and kind of get a feel for what they had done during the off season and how they were doing, how their families were doing. And I think that's one of the things that players really love about him.
I mentioned the top 10 first base prospects as MLB Pipeline unveils their top 10 prospects at every position. They started the week with right-handed pitchers, then lefties, then they moved to catchers, and then first base was today, Friday, as we record this podcast. They'll also move around the diamond and into the outfield before the top 100 list is unveiled on January 27th. But on the first base list, the D-backs checked in. Pavin Smith, number three on the list, which is pretty impressive for a guy who was drafted just last year out of the University of Virginia. Of course, he was the number seven overall pick. Beyond just being number three on their list, he was also picked as the tied for the highest hit tool at 60 and given the highest floor, which I think is an important thing, an important distinction for prospects, because a lot of prospects, let's face it, end up being busts. But if you're a guy that people consider to have that high floor, there's a much better chance that you're going to make it to some degree to, I think, to the big league level.
Yeah, that's a great point. And they're really excited about Pavin Smith. What they saw in just that half season kind of reaffirmed what they thought they were getting when they drafted him. A guy that has a great command, great feel for the strike zone, 27 walks, 24 strikeouts. That's some pretty impressive plate discipline for a guy just coming out of college in his first year of pro ball. So they really liked that. They thought that the ball came off his bat with his exit velocity was very good. And even around the first base, you know, he has really good footwork, soft hands, and a good arm, which is something that sometimes gets overlooked when it comes to first baseman, but can be important, not just in, you know, turning the double play there, but on relay throws and all kinds of things. So they're excited, 21 years old. They like what they've got in him, and they feel like he's a guy that's going to rise pretty quickly through the system as a polished hitter, which is kind of what they were expecting when they selected him out of Virginia last year.
Yeah, I was going to say the college players obviously move a lot quicker than the high school players, get to the big leagues a lot quicker, and he is a first baseman. Obviously, you have Paul Goldschmidt there, but Goldschmidt's contract will run out eventually. Is the thought process Pavin Smith, if they can't extend or bring Goldschmidt back at some point, do they think Pavin Smith can be a guy that fills that hole?
Well, certainly they believe he's going to be a big league player and a big league first baseman. So I guess that he could end up being the guy that replaces Goldschmidt if they don't sign him to an extension or he's coming up here. But I think that's one of the things that they've kind of steered away from trying to say, because that would put obviously a lot of pressure on a young kid. So I think they're going to take it step by step with him, but they are impressed with what they've seen so far and do think that he's a guy that's going to move pretty quickly through the system.
All right, one last topic to get to with you. The Hall of Fame announcement is coming next Wednesday, the 24th of January. Curt Schilling continues to be on the list. Obviously, a great run with the D-backs. Schilling played for numerous teams, but winning that World Series title with the D-backs, one of the high points in his career before he went to Boston, won one more with the Red Sox. But Schilling, sixth year on the ballot out of 10, currently at 65.6%. I think last time I checked the ballots that have already been unveiled and tabulated on the internet, about half of those have come in so far. So he continues to make up ground. That number will come down a little more than likely between now and Wednesday when all of the ballots are unveiled. Last year, though, he finished at 45%. So to be at 65 right now, it seems like he's heading in the right direction, Steve.
Yeah, you know, he's one of those cases, at least for me, when you look at it, is kind of a borderline case. And, you know, it could go either way on him. I don't have a vote, just to get that out of the way here. But it's going to be fascinating to kind of see what happens, you know, with him this year. Does he go back up? I know last year there was some controversy about some of his statements and maybe that had hurt him in the balloting and whatnot. So as you pointed out, so far the ballots that have been revealed has him making a really big jump. And that'll be fascinating to see if even a little bit of that translates and what that might mean going forward, as some of these, you know, we've got a couple of stacked ballots coming up, but after that, it kind of quiets down for the last few years of his eligibility. And if he continues to gain, that would certainly be a good sign for him.
I had this conversation when talking to some of our other writers about Mike Mussina, comparing Mussina's numbers to Jack Morris. And I think Curt Schilling can, not that the numbers are as similar, but still the same discussion. When you see Jack Morris and the numbers he posted throughout his career, and obviously he had the big moments in the postseason like Curt Schilling did, you see Jack Morris now a Hall of Famer. I feel like when you look at his career and then look at Schilling and Mussina as well, suddenly it almost seems like those guys have to be Hall of Famers if Jack Morris is a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, you know, with Jack, it took until the Veterans Committee or whatever they call that now, the era committee, to get him in. So you wonder if that's going to be the case. Will a guy like Schilling or especially Mike Mussina, will they be people that are more appreciated as time goes on and maybe after their 10 years on the ballot passes, will they end up getting in that way as opposed to with the writers this time around?
Mussina so far on a little bit better of a track than Schilling, but Schilling actually not too far behind him. So it'll be interesting to see. I feel like that group of guys, they're similar in their accomplishments, how they did it, and we will find out if they all end up being Hall of Famers sooner or later. This has been MLB.com Extras, our D-backs edition. For Steve Gilbert, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here along with Chris Haft, our MLB.com Giants reporter. And, Chris, this is a team and a roster that's going to look a lot different on opening day with some veterans from other teams. They've added a couple now, faces of the franchises, of other franchises, into the mix with the Giants, and it makes for an interesting roster, and we're going to get into that a little bit. Also get into the Hall of Fame voting. The vote comes out next Wednesday for the 2018 Hall of Fame, but Evan Longoria and Andrew McCutchen, basically the face of the Rays and the face of the Pirates, are now members of the Giants. It's certainly a go-for-it-now mentality, and the Giants have, we've known, they weren't going to rebuild here, and these are two veteran guys that they've added. Do you like the McCutchen move as you see it right now?
Right now, sure. And you know, he gives them an awful lot. He could hit in the middle of the order. I think they're considering him for leadoff, even though he's shifting from center to right. It should be a good time for him to do that sort of thing. I mean, he may have a little trouble learning the nooks and crannies of that right field at AT&T Park. But I think of, you know, he's a 9-year major league veteran. He'll get the hang of it. And he's got a little bit of a swagger, which I think the Giants need right now, attitude-wise.
When you think about right field at AT&T Park, I kind of think of like Fenway Park. It's right field, but it's a position that maybe is better served for a center field type player because there's so much space out there. So it seems to make sense to me that McCutchen would be a guy that could be effective. You mentioned it, though. It's going to take some time. But when you look at the fact that he's been a center fielder most of his career, he should fit in nicely in right field eventually.
He should, and he's played there, of course. Obviously, he's played at the park before, so that gives him a little bit of a jump start on learning the position, and he'll have no shortage of people trying to help him to get acclimated as quickly as possible.
Obviously, he's a guy who's a former National League Most Valuable Player. The last 2 years have been inconsistent. I guess that might be the nice way of saying it. He's had some real bad stretches, but then he's looked good at times as well. And it does almost look like he's aged as a player, but he's only 31 years old. I think that is something that when you look at the age and you look at the player, he should have some prime years left. Is that the way the Giants see this?
Oh, obviously that's the way the Giants feel. I think they're thinking partially, even though he was a big man in Pittsburgh, as we all know and as you mentioned, I believe the Giants feel that a change of scenery is going to help him.
Yeah, maybe a little less pressure on him because, as you mentioned, he goes from the face of the franchise to being just another guy in a lineup where the face of the franchise is obviously Buster Posey and Madison Bumgarner and those guys who have certainly won already. How about the package that the Giants gave up? Obviously, Brian Reynolds is a guy with some high upside. Kyle Crick, I feel like at one time was thought of more highly than he is right now. And then obviously there's some international bonus money in there as well. But overall, when I look at this, it seems pretty fair for 1 year of Andrew McCutchen, of course, before he becomes a free agent. The Giants didn't have to give up too much in this deal.
The Giants did not give up too much, Tim. And even though they lost Christian Arroyo in the trade for Evan Longoria, it got through this period without trading any, you know, three of their four, at least, really top prospects who they're, you know, really high on for the future. And that's, Helloy, Ray Ramos, Tyler Beatty, the right-hander, Ramos being an outfielder, and Chris Shaw, slugging first baseman outfielder. So I think they feel pretty good about that.
So McCutchen is added, Longoria is added. Do you feel like at this point the Giants have, for the most part, finished off their off-season plans, or is there more moves to be made?
Oh, there's more. They've got to get a center fielder. Probably, 1 year. They believe a lot in Steven Duggar, minor league prospect, so it's probably going to be the guy they get. Well, I see them signing one of a number of free agent center fielder types available, you know, Cameron Maben, John Jay, there's Austin Jackson. There's a lot out there who they could probably, Giants could probably latch on to.
Would they consider making a move for be another trade, but I think a trade in which you wouldn't really have to give up very much? How about a guy like Denard Span?
you're pretty funny.
Right? Bring him back.
Yeah, right.
All right, so we talked about McCutchen, Longoria meeting with the media today in San Francisco. It's obviously been a while since this deal was actually made, but Longoria has been busy. He's made it out to San Francisco today. Let's hear a little bit about what Longoria had to say about joining a new franchise after being in Tampa Bay so long.
Being able to come to an organization in a city and a place like this, makes it a little bit easier. You know, obviously the recent success of the organization is something that sticks out in my mind and reason for me to believe that we're not far off from getting back to that point again. I reached out to Buster and Madison first just because, you know, I wanted to shoot a text message and get it out there that I was excited to be here, and kind of the same thing I said to you guys, like, I'm not trying to, you know, I'm here to win, and I'm here to kind of just do what everybody else, what you got, follow the example that you guys have set, over the years. And I've touched base with quite a few guys that are, currently, mainstays here, and they've all assured me that they're excited, and that makes me excited, and kind of just puts me at ease a little bit. As a veteran player coming into another clubhouse with some veteran guys, it's kind of tough to envision what it's going to be like until you're there. And so, I think my goal is to just make that as seamless as possible, and just kind of fit in. You know, it's like a new kid being at a new school. You know, just kind of try and slide in under the radar. I mean, the goal is to score runs. You know, and I think, you know, the offense that we've put together is going to be able to do that. And home runs and those things they come, and especially when you're put in a lineup with the potential that this one has.
So good stuff from Longoria. Sounds excited to be a Giant, and we will see how all these moves play off throughout the 2018 season. I mentioned the Hall of Fame, and obviously some interesting former Giants continue to be on that ballot. These discussions come up every year, Chris, and Barry Bonds, sixth year on the ballot now out of 10. Currently right now, when you look at the percentages, he's right around 65%. About half of the ballots have been totaled thus far as they get collected and kind of leaked out and reported onto the internet. That will drop. It always does as more and more of the ballots come out. But that said, it seems like he will make up a little ground again as he passes the halfway point as far as time goes on the ballot. Do you like the trajectory he's on right now when you think about him eventually getting into the Hall of Fame, or do you think four more years after this it's going to be tough for him to get to that 75%?
I think it's definitely a trajectory for induction, Tim. It really is. I mean, just look at what the percentages the last 4 years. I think it's gone from 35 to 44 to 35 to 44 to what it is this year. And, the trend is obviously up. The only thing that could possibly hurt him is big influx of strong candidates in the next couple of years. That could hurt any candidate. But with Bonds having built up that much support, I doubt he's going to get snubbed. I think he'll gain election.
Jeff Kent is another one of those names that always gets some big arguments, although he's trending in the wrong direction. Fifth year on the ballot, right now at 11.2%. Last year he finished up at 16.7%. He's an interesting guy, and obviously he spent some great years with San Francisco on the same teams as Barry Bonds. Why do you think he hasn't gotten more recognition on this ballot?
He didn't get that much recognition as a player, actually.
That's fair to say,
so I think that's carried over. I wish people would realize, obviously I'm a Kent voter. I've voted for him every year. He's been on the ballot. Maybe it's because I saw him play a lot over those years when he was a peak player, peak performer. But he was a peak performer. He came through a clutch. He did the job defensively. Wasn't flashy, but got the job done. And yes, he and Barry Bonds formed a formidable 1-2 punch there for the Giants.
So it doesn't look like he's on a trajectory at all to get there, but continues to be on the ballot, and I'm sure will be. And he'll get talk from year to year about why he's not respected as much as some other guys, certainly, because he put up some real big numbers for a time in San Francisco and also to some part in Los Angeles. One other guy on this ballot I wanted to talk about is Omar Vizquel, not thought of as a Giant, but played towards the end of his years, 05 to 08, when he was 38 to when he was 41. Actually, won his last two Gold Gloves with the Giants. He's on the ballot for the first time this year. He's at 29.9% right now. That's not a bad start. I mean, obviously, it'll take some time, but it seems like he has a little bit of a backing. And if you're in the 20s to start, it can be a long haul to get up to that 75, but it's not out of the picture that it could happen over time. Maybe people respect the defense and things he did more and more as years go on. But what do you remember about that short stretch that Omar Vizquel was on the Giants?
Magical. He was a magician. Maybe not in the Ozzie Smith sense, Tim, but he handled routine plays so well. He never seemed to get a bad hop, and that's because he was always in position to receive the ball. And he was such an intelligent player. To do things like take the throw as a cutoff man, and then he would unexpectedly throw to third base to the runner rounding third. He would, he'd pick him up. They'd round third, they'd get him, they'd pick him off, get the runner. He was such an intelligent player. It was something to behold. And his short tenure in the National League, I think, is going to help him gain election.
Yeah, most of the time he spent in the AL, obviously, and to go into the NL late in his career like that, still be effective, so good with the glove for so many years, obviously in Cleveland for so long, but also San Francisco and a few other stops. All right, this has been MLB.com Extras, our Giants edition. For Chris Haft, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with AJ Cassavell, who's back after traveling the world, but you traveled a little bit, obviously. Congratulations on the honeymoon, getting back, and welcome back to the grind of the slow 2017-18 offseason.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. I can't say I'm thrilled to be back after 2 weeks in Argentina, which were fantastic and included a lot of steak, a lot of wine, and a lot of traveling. But there are worse places to return to in the United States than San Diego. So happy to be back and ready to kind of get things going here in 2018.
You can get all that stuff in San Diego. It'll just cost you a lot more. I have nothing to say about that. All right, fine. That's what we'll move on to baseball. Second base, still an issue for these Padres. I want to start there. We'll also get into a lot of prospect stuff and also the Hall of Fame ballot that's out right now. But they obviously have made some moves. They traded away Solarte. That helped ease the logjam in the infield. They have Carlos Asuaje, though, Corey Spangenberg, Chase Headley. All those guys, second base, third base in the mix there. What's the current plan as far as as far as how this team's going to handle these positions?
I don't know if they have a finalized plan with those three guys yet. I think they're kind of weighing maybe some of their offers trade-wise in the infield still going forward. I know Chase Headley's a guy that if the right offer presents itself, he could be kind of a useful bat for a contender, a switch hitter who could maybe see some useful time. But as it stands right now, with Headley on the roster, with Headley probably getting the bulk of the time at third base, I'd say there's those three guys competing for two spots. Headley's the favorite for third, so that would kind of seem to leave Corey Spangenberg and Carlos Asuaje for second base, which is interesting because Spangenberg spent all last season transitioning from second to third, and now that they have another third baseman, the question becomes, well, do you move him back to second? Is he kind of the guy who can handle playing second base, playing third base, maybe even some left field. I mean, he's told me in the past that he would love to be, he would love to fill kind of the Ben Zobrist mold. Whether that's something he can do, it kind of remains to be seen, because last year he spent pretty much all his time at third base with some time sprinkled here and there in left field. But it's definitely up in the air, and there's another interesting question to be asked if Headley gets moved before opening day, whether that means whether the Padres would just be set then with Suárez at second base and Spangenberg at third, or do they maybe give a prospect like Luis Urias a chance? Where does Christian Villanueva, who kind of came onto the scene late last season, where does he stand in all this? Does he have a shot at making the roster? And so there's a lot of questions to be answered. I would guess that we would enter spring training with still plenty of those questions unanswered, and maybe performance or trades or who knows what will tilt the balance in favor of one or two starters.
Yeah, all these discussions, I think, are more interesting with the Padres because of the young talent that's on its way as well. With every decision they make, they have to kind of keep an eye down on the farm as well. And that brings us into another discussion, which is the non-roster invites for spring training, just coming out today as we record this podcast on Thursday. And it's an interesting group because a lot of those young, talented players are on the list. You mentioned Luis Urias. He's one of those guys. Fernando Tatis Jr., who I know people really want to get a look at, he's on that list as well. It's going to be a fun spring training for you.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it's going to be kind of the early part of camp, which can sometimes feel like a little bit of a grind where the regulars aren't playing a whole lot. For the Padres, I mean, A.J. Preller has never been one to shy away from giving his young guys chances. He very much goes by the mantra that regardless of age, if their performance dictates it, then they'll get a chance at the next level. And so he's essentially given big league invites to the entire AA rotation. He's given a big league invite to Fernando Tatis, who's 19 years old and spent most of the season last year in single A. And so I think the beginning of spring training will probably be as interesting as any part of camp, because you'll get a chance to see Fernando Tatis probably combined with Urias as maybe the Padres' double play duo of the future. You'll get a chance to see guys like Cal Quantrill, Joey Lucchese, Eric Lauer. I don't think any of those guys, aside from maybe Urias, has a chance to make the big league roster, but in a way it's an audition for some of them for potential midseason call-ups. And I think especially with some of the pitchers, the Padres think they're progressing pretty quickly and could see maybe a Quantrill or a Lucchese breaking the big leagues sometime later in the season. And so it's an audition for some of these guys. It's the first chance for the Padres to see them against major league talent. And I think for a lot of Padres fans, it's the first chance to see these guys on the field playing with Padres across their chest.
Yeah, and for the pitchers, it's pretty clear the team is kind of leaving openings for these guys to make their way at some point, whether they're, you know, signing short-term deals with guys or non-roster invites outside of the organization to stopgap the rotation until some of these guys are ready and they can battle it out for spots in that rotation. The top 10 position lists are coming out this week and next on MLB Pipeline. They started on Tuesday with right-handed pitchers. Wednesday was left-handed pitchers, and that's when the Padres kind of got to flex their muscles a little bit, AJ. Mackenzie Gore checked in at number one. Adrian Morahone checked in at number six. Anytime you have two players on any of these top 10 lists, it's pretty impressive, and to be two left-handed pitchers is even more impressive. Now, Gore is obviously a long way away, but has all the signs of being a top-level guy. These are exciting times because you mentioned the double-A guys, and obviously Gore's not even to that level yet.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good assessment, that they're kind of leaving the rotation open for some of these guys to come in and seize those spots. We talked about the double-A guys. They're all going to get their chance soon enough, but I think the real strength of the Padres system resides, pitching-wise at least, resides in those lower levels with Mackenzie Gore, Adrian Morejon. Michelle Baez is another example. He didn't crack the top 10 righties, but he's another guy who I think people are very high on. And with Gore and Morejon, I think the most impressive thing about them both being ranked so high on the top prospects list is both of them are 18. And I think a lot of time with these lists, you see maybe more polished guy or a guy whose skill set might be a little more honed. Well, both of them are still somewhat raw, and I think they're just so talented that you kind of start to build a rotation in San Diego, or at least the plan is in the next 2 years you build a rotation in San Diego with some of these double-A guys, the Cal Quantrills, Eric Lauers, whoever else comes in and makes an impact. And then, theoretically, you have these two young stud left-handers who can come in and maybe put that rotation from an adequate young rotation kind of over the top into what the Padres hope is a contender for a few years to come.
Yeah, the positive of them being 18 years old is you can really dream on these guys being special pitchers. The negative is obviously a lot can go wrong, but that's just the way it goes with prospects for sure. And the key is to have a lot of them, and the Padres certainly have that taken care of right now. Things look bright for the future in San Diego. I want to talk about the Hall of Fame a little bit as well. And Trevor Hoffman, so close a year ago, 74%. Of the ballots he was on in 2017. You have to get to 75 to get into the Hall of Fame. And this year is shaping up to be really similar. Currently, the last time I checked the online totals, he's at 77.8%. We're about halfway as far as the ballots that have been reported. The announcement coming out next Wednesday. Usually those percentages drop as we get closer and closer to the actual announcement. So it makes you think, AJ, that maybe for the second straight year, Hoffman could end up just missing out on the Hall of Fame.
It's going to be close again. I think that what we noticed with Hoffman the first 2 years, though, is a lot of those writers that kind of that don't reveal their ballots until after the voting or don't reveal their ballots at all, those ballots are usually smaller. But in Hoffman's case, he's actually been more immune to that maybe drop-off than some of the other guys were. And so if you just look at trends, I believe he's gained a few votes. He's gained probably 7 or 8 votes, and he was 5 votes short last year. Now it's a matter of first-time ballots, or do guys maybe leave him off their ballot as it gets possibly more crowded? It's going to come right down to the wire. But I think that the concept that a guy who has 78% of the revealed ballots before the actual results are announced, usually that number dips, but with Hoffman in the past, that dip hasn't been as extreme, and I think he'll again be right around 75. I based on what I've seen in the voting and kind of how trends work historically, I know Padre fans won't want me to jinx this, but I think his chances are probably pretty decent of making Hall of Fame this year.
Now, the silver lining, if he doesn't get in this year, is that next year is the first year that Mariano Rivera will be on the ballot, who will certainly be a first ballot guy. And you think about the two awards right now for best closer in baseball. The National League Award is the Hoffman Award and the American League, the Rivera. It would be kind of fitting for those guys to go into Cooperstown together. I'm sure Hoffman would rather get in there this year, but if he has to wait another year, that would be pretty cool.
It'd be a cool kind of setup for baseball. You can kind of honor to the two arguably best closers of all time. And the one thing I keep coming back to with Padre fans who are upset that Hoffman hasn't been inducted yet is the Hall of Fame is the Hall of Fame. Whether you get in on the fifth try or whether you get in on the third try or whether you get in the first or the tenth or whatever, you're a Hall of Famer the minute you get in. And it's no fun sitting around waiting and hoping and not knowing whether he's going to get in. But If the trends hold up, he's going to get in at some point. And if it's next year with Mariano Rivera, if it's this year, God forbid for Padre fans, a few years down the road, it seems likely he gets in eventually. And once he's in, he's a Hall of Famer. And I know some people like to make a big deal out of first ballot or whatever, but the Hall of Fame is the Hall of Fame. And if you're a Hall of Famer, I think that pretty much says it all. There's no qualification to that.
Yeah, just ask our MLB.com co-worker, Jack Morris, who is finally going in this summer after 23 years. He waited the 5 years, then 15 years on the ballot, and then a few more years until the Veterans Committee could take care of him. He doesn't care. I mean, he cared during those 23 years, but now that he's in, and he'll just take that at that. All right, the other guy with Padres connections is Fred McGriff. Just spent a couple of years with the Padres, really, 91, 92, part of 93, 84 home runs with the Padres. He was an all-star in 92. He's in his ninth year on the ballot, 18% right now. So not looking great for McGriff, but another guy with some Padres ties that is on this Hall of Fame ballot with one more year after this year. That has been MLB.com Extras, our Padres edition. For AJ Cassavell, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here with Thomas Harding, our MLB.com Rockies reporter on the Rockies podcast again this week. And Thomas, about the same stuff that we've been talking about. We're going to get into some other stuff later in the podcast. The caravan's going on for the Rockies right now, so they're around the state and even crossing state borders to visit some markets and get out the word about this talented team. We'll also talk about Larry Walker and his fight to get into the Hall of Fame. But first, let's start with news and notes, which is, like I said, a whole lot of nothing right now. The question is, we keep saying that there's still some work to be done, whether it's an outfielder or first baseman or somebody who can do both. But that's not necessarily the case, right? Should we stop with that and maybe think this team maybe is done?
Well, it's possible that this team is done. I mean, and in my checking around, what I'm hearing is that beyond monitoring the market, the Rockies have been extremely quiet since signing the three relief pitchers, Wade Davis, Brian Shaw, and Jake McGee. They could use another corner bat. When I look at that lineup right now, I don't know that I can put a guy in the third position in that lineup. However, they do have a couple of prospects, and I think that if you look at what they did with the pitching last year, where they decided that they were going to go from within, it's not outside the realm of possibility they stick with what they have. Ryan McMahon had a very good year in the minors last year, and that was in Double-A and Triple-A. So you go into this year, and are you ready to either turn over first base to him or have a share at first base? Like, say, an Ian Desmond could play some first base when Ryan McMahon is not in the lineup, and then go out into the outfield on other days. When you look at the outfield situation, Desmond could fit in left field with Gerardo Parra in right, or you could leave Parra in left if David Dahl comes back from his injury that kept him out all of last season. That was an impact bat in 2016, but he had that rib issue last year that never allowed him back into the majors. He was doing well on minor league rehab, but he aggravated that. It showed up in the form of a back spasm. So what if David Dahl is in right field, say, and Gerardo Parra is in left, and at first base is Ian Desmond, but you're easing a Ryan McMahon into the lineup, and then you can move Desmond around as the season goes. So it is possible that they're done. I'm not saying that they are, but with the market moving so slowly and so deliberately, you could end up with anything. You could end up with the Rockies going from within, or you could end up with the Rockies ending up with a impact bat that you probably didn't expect. So anything can happen in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, and we're down to the point where it really is the next couple of weeks, because spring training, basically less than a month away, teams need to get things going, and I'm sure the players at this point are kind of getting antsy with no home yet for the upcoming season. All right. The Rockies have been on the road, as I mentioned, the caravan traveling around Colorado, even making it down to Albuquerque, New Mexico. A lot of players and even Bud Black have been on the caravan. You've made a number of stops with them. How's it been going so far? This is a great way for the team to just kind of visit outside of Denver and get the word out about this team.
Well, I'll tell you what, the enthusiasm that I saw, I mean, I feel like there's more than the caravan's past. And I was talking to John Gray last night, and John had been to Albuquerque, spent a full day there making trips, and then also to Colorado Springs yesterday, and in Denver today. And he was saying that what it's done for him is let him know that this franchise reaches far beyond Denver. That's one of the reasons they called it the Colorado Rockies. You know, when they came in, there were no teams in the Mountain Time Zone, and they really put forth an effort. And, I mean, their reach goes into Salt Lake City, where I think the games are on all the time. So being able to see that really made a difference for Gray. And today I spent some time with Kyle Freeland, a group of Rockies, Freeland included, went to Home Elementary in Denver, which is where Freeland went to elementary school. His mom is still a teacher there. I even met the music teacher there, which was just fascinating, because I found out that Kyle is the second most famous person from Home Elementary in Denver. The first is Don Cheadle. He came through there a while ago, did musicals there. They tried to put Kyle in a musical, but as the teacher said, his voice wasn't what it is now. She's like, oh, if I knew his voice was going to be so deep, who knows? I would have worked with him more. So it was a good experience being around. The kids were really excited about it. It's Rockies Day around here in Denver. I'm seeing more young people getting involved with this team. I think the trip to the playoffs last year really made a difference.
Yeah, that's cool. Great trivia as well. Good stuff here on the podcast. All right, one more thing I want to talk to you about, Thomas, we can get into a little bit, is Larry Walker. He's on the Hall of Fame ballot again. This is his eighth year on the ballot. He's at 40.7% right now with about half of those ballots tabulated. 2017, he finished at 21.9%. So it doesn't look good for Larry Walker right now. But it's a guy, it's such a fascinating case, I think, for the Hall of Fame, because you look at the numbers and obviously tremendous 383 career home runs. He could kind of do everything, defense, offense. He could run the bases despite being a big guy. But it seems like Coors Field just kills him. And when people see, you hear the name Larry Walker, you immediately say, oh, he was just good because he played at Coors Field. I don't think that's fair.
No, it's not fair. I mean, because I think that what people don't get, and even people that I'm close to in this game, what they don't get about Coors Field, I'll first attack that factor, is while it is a place that can inflate your offensive numbers, there is no doubt about that. A couple of things happen. Games tend to last a lot longer there, and it's an atmosphere where people train for endurance events in Colorado. But doing this every day, it takes a beating. I mean, the Rockies have changed so many things about how and when they travel, where they stay in hotels, how they eat, all because of this atmosphere. So you're going in and out of this atmosphere, so it weighs on you physically. There are certain injuries that can crop up. Then after that, you play 81 games here, but you play 81 games elsewhere. And I think what people think is, oh, you go to Denver, you're playing on the moon. Then you come back from the moon, and you're in the Earth's atmosphere, but you just snap back into it as if you're anywhere else. This team has to adjust to how the ball breaks when they go on the road. So what a lot of people say is they'll look at the road number and say, oh, that's the true player. That's as unusual as playing at home because you never really get used to one atmosphere. So I think that Coors Field has been a bit unfair. It's funny, too, during Walker's career, and I came in the 2000 season, he was still a dominant player in the league. I mean, there were people that put him kind of right around the, you know, in the same category as a Barry Bonds as a 5-tool player. But, you know, the only thing that bothered me at that time was he did have a lot of injuries that kept him off the field. I remember once talking to him about the Hall of Fame, and also that was during the era where guys took, certain supplements. And he was never going to have the power numbers of those guys. He's like, hey, I may not get in the Hall of Fame without a ticket. But I think since his career has ended and since we've seen some of the controversies, people took a fresh look at Larry Walker. And I do think that there are people who've taken a very smart statistical look at Larry Walker. And, you know, here in Denver, we had a Hall of Fame type player under our nose and probably didn't appreciate him as much at the time as we do in retrospect.
People that want to feel even better about Larry Walker being a Hall of Fame type guy, you should read Joe Posnanski's article on MLB.com. He did some research on Baseball Reference, Thomas. He looked up the top 100 all-time guys in batting runs, fielding runs, and base running runs. And the interesting thing about those lists is most of the time guys are on that list, one of those lists, even Hall of Famers, one of those lists. There are actually only three players all-time that are on all three lists. Willie Mays, he was pretty good. Barry Bonds, obviously a Hall of Famer, if not for the PEDs. And Larry Walker. So Mays, Bonds, and Walker. It's an amazing list, and it just goes to show what an all-around player Larry Walker was.
I'll have to say this. As far as, and this is, there are a couple of things that have nothing to do with the stats that put Larry Walker in a very great exclusive category for me, and these are eye test things or ear test things even, is that when I would go down and watch batting practice and hear batting practice, the ball came off the bat off Larry Walker's bat. The only other guys that I can compare it to were Mike Piazza, Mark McGwire, and Barry Bonds. The explosion, the way that he hit, and he carried that into games with him. The other thing that I will always appreciate is Larry Walker running the bases. There is, it's textbook, but it's power also, because this is a big man, you know, 235, 240-pound guy who ran the bases so smoothly and so efficiently and with so much power and speed. Those are things that, you know, when you watch a guy's career, those always stick with you. It's not all about the numbers. I've never been one guy that will watch a game and then pull out my slide rule and my calculator and computer and say, oh, this is good. You know, sometimes you just have to watch it, feel it, and see it.
So for Walker, 8 years on the ballot now. He's got two more chances after this. We'll see how that goes. But certainly a guy that is fascinating guy in the discussion and worth at least looking at the numbers, looking what he did, and consider him as a Hall of Famer. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Rockies edition. For Thomas Harding, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with Ken Gernick, our MLB.com Dodgers reporter, as we are ready to talk about the Dodgers a little bit more. We're going to get into Cody Bellinger, what he's been up to during the offseason. Yu Darvish as well, as he continues to be in some rumors with the Dodgers. And Walker Buehler, who's checking in on the MLB Pipeline top five right-handed pitchers list that came out on Tuesday. Ken, let's start with Darvish. There was a report, I guess almost a week ago now, that on Twitter that it was down to five teams with Darvish, and then Darvish actually replied to that tweet by saying that there was a sixth team, and a lot of people assume that that team was the Dodgers. Is it your understanding that they're at least still in somewhat of the game with Darvish at this point?
Well, I think they've always wanted to bring him back.
Right.
And until he signs somewhere else, I think they're still in the picture. They haven't hidden the fact that they want to get under the tax threshold this year. And the Matt Kemp trade was all about doing that and deferring $25 million to the 19 payroll and reducing the 18 payroll. So for them to get somebody like a Darvish, they pretty much have to move another salary and something substantial, whether that would be Kemp or part of Kemp's salary or someone else on the team like a Forsythe or a Grandal, somebody with a significant salary. If they do want to stay under that limit, and they've made all indications that they do, then they probably have to move somebody else in order to sign Darvish. But until Darvish signs somewhere else, you have to assume that the Dodgers are a logical candidate for him to land.
Would you think that they would, as a team, just instead of taking a gamble of sorts, would they make room for him financially before actually making the move to sign him? Or do you think they would sign him and then try to clear that money?
Well, I think a lot of that depends on Darvish. You know, yeah. This isn't a one-way operation here. So Darvish has a lot to say with the timing and where he goes. So I'm sure that they're in communication. And to whatever extent they feel comfortable, they've probably laid out their game plan here. But there's a lot that's beyond their control. You know, they can't control for sure that someone will take one of those salaries, and they can't control whether Darvish gets an offer that he wants to take from somewhere else. So this is the typical free agent give and take. It's never completely up to the ball club.
Of course. This is mostly, I guess, speculation to a degree. But when you think about a year from now and the fact that Clayton Kershaw can opt out of his contract and in theory could leave the Dodgers and end up on another team, I would think signing Darvish to a multiple year deal would at least somewhat cover them in that situation. If they were to lose Clayton Kershaw down the road, to have Darvish sign for multiple years, at least you have that guy that can be that one or two pitcher if you do lose Kershaw, because, hey, at this point, I guess you have to look at that as a possibility.
Well, again, it's all speculation. You know, you could look at it the other way. If they sign Darvish, maybe they're preparing for him to leave, and maybe they don't make an offer for him. So,
right.
You know, and then, of course, that's all assuming that he's going to opt out, and we don't know that that's the case either. So, you know, I guess you can speculate in every direction you want. But I know right now they haven't brought in any other starting pitchers to replace Darvish, which, you know, kind of reading between the lines, it's an indication that they're still thinking about bringing Darvish back. If they had gone out and gone after an Arrieta or even somebody cheaper, you know, they would have locked up that spot. They obviously haven't done that, so that tells me that Darvish is still on their radar.
Absolutely. They are in a good position where they have other options as well if needed, and that brings us to the next thing I wanted to talk to you about was Walker Buehler, the MLB Pipeline top 10 position lists are coming out this week. It started with right-handed pitchers on Tuesday. Lefties came out today, Wednesday, as we tape this podcast, and then we'll go through there around the entire diamond before the top 100 prospects is unveiled next week. But Walker Buehler checking in at number five as far as top five right-handers. And one thing that he has that some of the other pitchers on the list don't have is major league experience. What a run he had in 2017, starting the year in the lower levels of the minors and finishing the year up with the major league team. Obviously, he's a guy who has been brought along to be a starter. He pitched out of the bullpen late last year for the Dodgers. Do they still, though, view him? Obviously, that was a situation where you're calling him up late in the year. Is he still viewed throughout this organization as a starter?
Yeah, definitely. He's a starter, and they've told him that. And they feel that any of their top prospects are starters until they prove otherwise that they can't do it, at which point they then – you know, start grooming him for the bullpen. But Walker Buehler is a starting pitcher right now. You know, the big question mark is how many innings he'll be able to throw this year, throwing fewer than 100 last year, coming in his first full season after Tommy John surgery. You know, the question is how can they extend him without pushing him too far? They had a similar situation going into last year with Julio Urias, and it didn't work out very well. He ended up blowing out his shoulder and had surgery. So this year, they now facing the same situation with Buehler. They want to be able to extend him and build on his innings, but he's not going to be able to jump from under 100 to 200, so it's unclear exactly how they'll manage that. But he won't be in the Dodger big league rotation from the start to the finish, that much you know.
Yeah, and with a guy with the potential that he has, maybe you're better off, taking the time, right? And then if he's as good as he could be, better off having him late in the season than early in the season, I would think.
Well, again, that was what they thought with Urias. But yeah. The problem there is when you bring somebody in spring training in February or early March and you want him to pitch into October, how do you moderate those innings over 8 months? And they tried to do it with Urias, starting him and backing off and starting him and backing off again. And, maybe that their method was unrelated to the fact that he got hurt, but he did get hurt. So, that is a cautionary tale for what they're going to do with Buehler, who coming in faces the same situation where he isn't built up for a full major league season. So how do you moderate that?
Yeah, and you mentioned the Tommy John surgery in his past as well, which obviously is another factor, I would think, in their thinking as far as bringing him along, because the last thing you need is for that elbow to go again. All right, Cody Bellinger, obviously coming off a tremendous rookie season, runaway rookie of the year in the National League, and you have a story going up on the site, Ken, about the fact that he's been working hard in the offseason and gaining muscle. Is that correct?
Right. Saw him last week at Dodger Stadium, and it was pretty clear that his upper body is really filled out. He said he gained at least 15 pounds, maybe a little more, during the off season, working out and eating better. And it shows. It's definitely clear that his upper body is stronger. And, kind of scary for the opposition when you think about the fact that he was unanimous Rookie of the Year and wasn't even in the kind of shape that he's in now. So he mentioned the specter of the sophomore slump looming out there, and he wants no part of that, so he feels he's doing whatever he can to mentally and physically put himself in the best position to succeed. I think a year ago coming into the season, he sure wasn't expecting to be their starting first baseman for most of the season and play almost a full season in the major league. So, that was an eye-opener for him. He had great success, and he wants to duplicate it.
Obviously, he doesn't need extra strength to add to his power, which he has plenty of, but 162 games is a long time, you mentioned. And last year, he didn't play the full 162. Is that, do you think, in his mind, it's just a matter of staying strong for the long haul, like you were saying, and getting through that entire year?
Yeah, exactly. And he did tail off in the postseason, and especially in the World Series, and that is a long year. Although he did play in the minor league, so he had about 150 games going into the postseason, and then you add another you know, close to 15 games. So, you know, it was a long year, and I think he felt it at the end, and he just wants to make himself stronger. You know, he's still a kid, so he's still learning. And, you know, I think one of the things that he learned last year is he needs to be physically and mentally stronger for what the major league, the full major league season going all the way into November, as it turned out, demands.
I also think naturally, right, you look at his frame a year ago in 2017, and he's a tall and lanky guy. It almost seemed like he was going to gain, you know, he was going to fill out at some point just based on his body type and the way how skinny he was. And I would think when he starts working out a little extra in the gym, considering his body type, and obviously this is doctors and physicians could talk more about that, but it seems like he had a frame that could more easily put on that extra muscle because he was such a lanky guy. I would think it maybe came easy for him.
Right, that and his young age. You know, he's sort of got that Sean Green build to him where he doesn't really look like he's ever going to get real heavy, but he did look almost skinny last year. Not that it impacted his power or anything. So I don't think this is meant, as you mentioned, to add more home runs. I think it's just to give him more strength and durability through the course of a full season.
Scary stuff for the rest of the National League. Absolutely. All right, this has been MLB.com Extras, our Dodgers edition. For Ken Gernick, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.